I'm Kevin Power, and this is Sascapes, the podcast featuring stories of arts, culture, and heritage in Saskatchewan. Welcome to episode 77 of Sascapes. This episode is sponsored by Sask Culture. Sask Culture is a nonprofit organization that helps nurture cultural engagement in Saskatchewan. Thanks to funding from the Saskatchewan Lottery's Trust Fund for Sport, Culture, and Recreation, Sask Culture is able to support many cultural groups that offer a wide range of cultural activities in communities throughout the province. For more information on all of the work being done by Sask Culture, as well as upcoming events, including Culture Days, visit saskculture.ca and iheartculture.ca. Now remember, you can find us in all the usual podcast streaming sites, including iTunes, or download the free app from the App Store or Google Play, depending on your kind of device. Stop by and say hello on Facebook, or follow me on Twitter. Just look for @Sascapes. If you'd like to sponsor your own podcast episode, feel free to connect with me for more information. Now, in this episode, we reach far into the past, making those stories live today and for our future generations. And by far, I mean a past that predates even the Sphinx, right here in Saskatchewan. Join me as I unearth some great conversations at the Saskatchewan Archaeological Society's 53rd Annual Gathering. We all have archaeology as part of our story. As Executive Director Thomas and Playford says in this episode, archaeology connects us all. So, Thomas and Playford, thank you for inviting me to the 53rd Annual Gathering of the Saskatchewan Archaeological Society. There's a mouthful.
Yes.
Here we sit at Wanuskewin Heritage Park on a beautiful sunny afternoon, and folks will be piling in soon, so I wanted to make sure to get you off to one side before the madness begins to talk a little bit about the work you folks do in the province, and then also a little bit about just what Saskatchewan has to offer in the world of archaeology. So, tell me a little bit about your background. Originally from Saskatchewan?
No, actually, I'm from Manitoba, so okay. Saskatchewan adjacent, you could say.
Okay.
I did do a master's degree here at the University of Saskatchewan a little bit longer ago than I'd like to admit, but it's been over a decade. I come from a small university, Brandon, Manitoba, at Brandon University.
I know it well.
Okay. I was very fortunate because we had a professor of archaeology who went out and did research. So he went out into the field. He did primary research in southern Manitoba. So coming into archaeology, I don't know if I really thought a lot about where I wanted to do it, but having a professor who did research in your own backyard is what got me excited about doing archaeology on the plains.
Right. But earlier than that, what was it about your memory of growing up that sort of would suggest that this is the path you'd wind up taking? Did you always want to dig up things?
Well, that's a really good question. It's one we often get as archaeologists. How did you get into archaeology? And I kind of have two answers to that. One, when I was a child, I always loved old things. I just, my parents went antiquing and we always went out to where my mom used to live on a homestead site and would visit that. And we talked about, you know, how people used to live in the past. And as a child, I read a lot of Little House on the Prairie books and was always fascinated with how people used to live.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really know what archaeology was. I was on a fishing trip on the Churchill River, and one of my dad's friends told us a little bit. We were staying at a fishing camp and talked a little bit about archaeology, and she was showing us some trade beads and some little pieces of pottery. And I spent the rest of that trip looking on that beach, and I was so disappointed because I didn't find anything else. And I was probably about 10 or 11, maybe 12. And as I grew up, I always kind of wanted to be an archaeologist, but thought it was unattainable. Thought it was Indiana Jones and it was Africa and, you know, Mexican ruins. And so going to university, somebody said, well, what if you could do anything, what would it be? And it was archaeology. And I was so lucky that the university I went to had an archaeologist with a research program. So I was able to pursue that dream right from the beginning of my academic education.
So what happens in this part where you graduate and then you find yourself as the executive director of SAS? What happened in between that point? Did you start a career as an archaeologist?
When I finished my master's degree, in archaeology, we always say having your master's is your most employable degree. Okay. Because usually a lot of regulations require a master's degree if you want to hold a permit to do an excavation. So if you're going into archaeology and you want to be an archaeologist, usually people attain that master's degree. And when I graduated with my master's degree, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. So I kind of went back home. I did some sessional teaching at Brandon University and got kind of reconnected with my undergraduate advisor, Dr. Nicholson, who was doing a large research-based project, a multi-million dollar project across Saskatchewan, Alberta, Manitoba, looking at past environments. And so I got a little bit involved with that. And through that, I ended up going into a PhD program. So I ended up spending quite a few years attaining my PhD in archaeology, looking at seasonality and subsistence of past cultures. And so it was kind of right as I was finishing up that PhD, the position for the SASAD came open. And when it had come open a few years earlier, I was in the middle of my PhD program and didn't feel I could apply for the job and was very envious of my friend, Talina, who was the successful candidate for it. And then, you know, we lost something because she went to Alberta to, with her husband who had a job in Alberta. And so I applied for the job and was so grateful to have it because it really is my dream job. I'm not just saying that to plug it, but it is the best of everything that you can, I think, that you can do with archaeology.
So what is it that the SAS, which is the abbreviation for Saskatchewan Archaeological Society and much easier to say, what is it that you folks are doing in the province that you are most proud of?
Oh, well, I think we do a lot. So we offer about 30 different programs and services throughout the year. But what I think I'm proud of two things. One is our outreach in terms of education, and that's partly this Archaeo Caravan program that we have that's been very successful. And I'm also really looking forward to the SAS being in the foreground of archaeologists working with First Nations and Métis and involving First Nations and Métis in archaeology, because a lot of the sites that we look at, for the most part, we think are, of course, the remnants of people who lived here thousands of years ago. And I believe it's everybody's heritage, but there's a special, unique role that First Nations and Métis people play in the archaeological heritage of the province. And we are changing. We're at a crossroads in archaeology where that's really going to become prevalent, where First Nations people are reclaiming their heritage or reclaiming their history, and archaeology is one way that they can do that. So we want to work with them, and I don't want to say for them, but we want to work with them to tell the whole story.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, the very nature of First Nations culture is a storytelling people. So they must be able to fill in a lot of the blanks around or certainly the story, paint the background around the objects that you're unearthing.
Yep, absolutely. There's always, archaeologists have long recognized that there's stories and there's value in the knowledge that First Nation people have. And I think there's more understanding of just how deep that knowledge is and how applicable it can be to a lot of our sites. So when you come from a, let's say from southern Saskatchewan, where there isn't a lot of First Nations living on the land as they did 200 or 300 years ago, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, we maybe thought there was no connection there. There was no connection between the First Nations and the artifacts that we're finding. And I don't think that's true, that there are stories there. We just have to, work with them, and we have to talk to them about what we're doing with archaeology and our purpose of it, that we're wanting to better understand the past. We're wanting to better understand how people lived in the past so we know more about the future, and that we're not going to be doing things that are disrespectful. We want to be respectful of First Nations culture, and I think we really can work with them in terms of better understanding archaeological history.
And in that work that you've done so far, do you, I'm just trying to imagine, and not being a member of the First Nations community, I can't really, but I'm wondering if there is such a sense of urgency within First Nations people to unearth artifacts. Where does archaeology fit within that culture? I would think storytelling takes precedence because there is such reverence for sacred land, period, without finding stuff there, for, you know, to use a layman's term. Yeah. So where does that, how does that fit in their culture?
Well, it really depends on the group, and then to some degree it depends on the person, right? Mm-hmm. So much like how some people in my own family don't have a lot of interest in archaeology. They think it's boring and tedious, and my family understands because I've drilled it into them, but some of my friends maybe, you know, make fun of me for counting thousands of pieces of bone frags, but there's always people who are interested. So it depends on the person, and it depends on the group. There's some groups that don't believe that you should dig anything up out of the ground. Mm-hmm. So how do we reconcile, how do we respect that when we're an archaeologist and one of the things that we do is we dig? Well, one of the things archaeology is moving towards is less intrusive methods. We're looking at ground penetrating radar, use of drone technology. So we don't have to necessarily dig into the ground and dig up those objects that might not be things we should be digging up. Mm-hmm. But there's other groups who, or other people who maybe are unsure what archaeology is or does, and thinks has an idea that we go out and we excavate burials, because that is something archaeologists did do at one time. Mm-hmm. We don't do that anymore, and we really want to let people know that. We're not out to dig up burials. We don't seek out burials to dig them up. We understand the sacredness of burials, but when burials are unearthed, we can maybe help put them back where they're supposed to be. So it's dispelling some of those myths, too, of what archaeologists are now today and compared to what we used to do. So it's rebuilding those relationships with First Nations.
Tell me about the Archaeo Caravan Project.
Okay. So the Archaeo Caravan Project had started before I came on as the executive director. So I really applaud our public education committee and our past ED and our past acting ED, because they were the drivers that brought this program together and really had the foresight of what it was. So this is a 5-year program. And what we've done is we've targeted different geographical regions of the province every year. And we're working with local community museums to help with their archaeological collections. And this came out because the SAS was getting calls from museums saying, they didn't know what these artifacts were. How do they interpret them? What's the importance of these arrowheads? And so there was a recognized need for these local community museums, which are fantastic. We have some great museums in Saskatchewan. But a lot of times the people running those museums are volunteers. They maybe don't have a background in archaeology, and they don't know what to do with these artifacts. So the program evolved as helping the museums with these collections. We would hire 2 summer staff, and they would go to these museums, look at the collections, and give the staff or the volunteers some ideas about what they have, what's unique. If they had questions about identification or display or interpretation, our staff could do that for them. With this, we also partnered a hands-on activity day with the youth. So it was a way to bring the school groups into the museum, because sometimes when you grow up in a small town, you go to the museum once and you never go back. So here was an opportunity to bring the school groups through, have this unique event, and we had things like pottery making and rock art making. And the favorite one is bison hunting, where we let the kids throw a spear thrower at a bison target and pretend that they're hunting for their supper. Mm-hmm. And it gives the school the opportunity to come in, learn about archaeology, but then also become familiar with the museum so that they're comfortable, they know about it, they can come back to this place. So it's kind of a win for the museum. It's a win for the school, and it was a win for us, because we that now have a much better understanding of the collections that are out there in those small town museums. So if somebody's interested in, say, looking at a certain type of arrowhead, we can look at our report and say, oh, you know, this, the Hague Museum has a wonderful collection of lithic tools. You should go check that out. So we're in the last year of the program this year. Up till now, we've reached over 9,000 people. So by the end of this year, we're going to reach over 10,000 people. Wow. Through this program.
Wow.
We visited, I think, over 100 communities, almost 100 museums. And we're really looking forward to, at the end of this year, going back and kind of looking at the data that we've collected, kind of the themes of what's come out from the museums, and how we can maybe adapt this program for other venues, whether it be schools, whether it be First Nations, maybe it's summer festivals or something like that. Taking this program, public awareness and sharing of information.
Hey, it's Kevin. I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. Just a quick reminder that the SaaScapes podcast is available for free on your favorite podcast app, or you can stream it from your browser. Check out the show notes for the link. On the SaaScapes homepage, you'll notice something new under the logo called SaaScapes Plus. You can't miss it. There's a big button saying support with a heart icon next to it. I'd love it if you could click on that button and help keep this podcast series going. When SaaScapes launched in May 2014, it was the first podcast in the province celebrating arts, culture, and heritage. In fact, you'd have been pretty hard-pressed to find any Saskatchewan podcasts. So I'd like to think that we paved the way. It's been because of your support that this podcast is now in its 9th year. Okay, that's it. Enjoy the rest of the episode. I wonder how many young minds you're influencing through that program that are going to wind up being archaeologists.
I wonder that too. And I wonder, because we see sometimes now when we talk to people who have an interest in archaeology and you ask them, how did you get into this? Sometimes it's because they came to Wanuskewin. Sometimes the Archaeo Caravan program was kind of a rethink of a program that happened back in the 90s. Maybe some of the people, some of the teachers we're working with took part in that original program. So I think that would be really interesting if there was a way we could actually track these people. Mm-hmm. But we'll see about that.
So what's the future for, when, let's say, if I were to ask you to throw me a 3-year plan from here, what do you most want to accomplish during your term? In a perfect world.
That's a hard. In a perfect world, I would love to have, the Saskatchewan Archaeological Society has chapters. So we have representatives, chapters throughout the province.
Right, how many chapters?
So we have 9 chapters right now. We just had a new chapter created in Prince Albert. So we're very excited to see the birth of a new chapter. And they're very grassroots driven. It's about that local community and the interest in that community. So we don't drive the chapters. It comes from the chapters, that there's enough people. The chapters are all semi-autonomous. They get some funding from us. They have a seat on our board, but their events and activities are up to them. What they do is up to them. So the chapters do different things. Some chapters do field trips. Some chapters do talks. Some chapters go out and visit sites. So we have currently 9 chapters, including our Saskatchewan Association of Professional Archaeologists. I would love to see a full-time staff person on every chapter. Mm. Like, if we could, that would be my dream, mm-hmm. where we actually had regional offices or something like that, where mm-hmm. because we're based in Saskatoon, our office is here in Saskatoon. We do try to cover the whole province, but the reality is it's a big province and it costs money to drive, you know, anywhere yeah, nowadays. Yeah, sure, yeah. So we don't get the reach necessarily, the geographical reach, as much as we want.
Okay.
But we see things like podcasts and YouTube videos, yes. where we can use those kind of avenues instead to reach people to hear about us. We've really increased our social media presence in the last couple of years. And that's something else that we want to move forward with, is knowing, finding better ways to engage a social media audience, but so that they become an engaged audience with our organization.
So if there are people listening and thinking, but I've always thought of archaeology as being very academic, very bookish, very sterile and dry, and perhaps not that interesting, dispel that myth for me. Tell me something about your study and the time when you got to get out in the field and your term now with SAS that just is so exciting. What about this field makes it so great to wake up every morning knowing that you're doing your dream job?
Well, for me, I think it's doing... I'm going to try to remember to stay on track and tell you two stories.
Yeah.
For me, for one thing, with working for the SAS, it's because it's different every day. Like, I am in the office a lot, but it's often on very different things. I'm writing grants. I'm writing an article. I'm talking to people. Somebody comes into the office with an artifact, with a big boulder of something that they want identified. So in that sense, for me, for the job, I love the diversity of it. I love that it's challenging. There's always something new. There's new things to think about, new ways to think about things, and I don't think, I hope I never stop learning about archaeology. And I think all archaeologists are like that to some degree. Mm-hmm. In terms of the actual physical act of being an archaeologist, one of the most exciting stories that I can share with you is this past summer, we were working at the far site, just about an hour south of Regina, a small community called Ogama. And what I love about this project that we did is it came to us from one of our founding members. So we're 53 years old. So our founding member, who was in his 20s when he joined the society, when he helped found it, is now in his 70s. And he goes out to the site and he kind of looks after. He's been a steward of the site for 20, 30 years. And we go out to the site. We did a little bit of a research project because it had been surface collected, meaning artifacts are found on the surface of the ground. Mm-hmm. He never knew if there was an intact component, if there was something below the surface that was where it had originally laid down. And it was a cultivated field, so we know that there's going to be artifacts in that cultivation zone that have been all mixed up. And while it's really nice to find them, they don't tell us a lot of information. On the very last day, the very last hour, sure enough, we find just a little bit of a pit that had been dug into the ground. So the people that were there 9,500 years ago had dug a little bit of a pit into the ground. They were boiling up bison bones and they had kind of pushed the bones back into this pit. And we found that because it was below that plow zone. So here we are on the last day of our dig, as always, because it's always the last day.
Yeah, right.
And we found points in situ and we were able to radiocarbon date the site to now 9,500 years ago.
Wow.
So that was exciting. I mean, that's it. I don't think it gets better than that. At the same time, when you're walking a field and say you're digging test pits and you find nothing and you find nothing, you find a tiny little flake, it's like, wow, somebody was here. So it almost doesn't matter what it is. It's what it represents. And that's where people were and the stories of what they were doing. One of the unique things I think about Saskatchewan archaeology is we have so many different types of sites. I think it's a very, it's a better kept secret than it should be is the effigy sites, the stone circle sites in Saskatchewan. These are amazing places to go see. Mm-hmm. And there we have some of them that are protected. Some of them are in provincial parks. You can go visit them. And I don't know if people know about those sites as much as we know about the Nazca lines or the burial mounds, the Mississippian mounds or something like that. We know about those places in Africa. We know about the Sphinx and the pyramid. Mm-hmm. Why do we not know about Cabri Lake Mountain that's here in Saskatchewan?
Tell me about that.
Cabri Lake is an area up by Kindersley, and it is one of our longtime members by the name of Ted Douglas has worked in that area for decades. He's a pilot. He did a lot of air photos, and there's human effigies laid out on the surface of the ground in the shape of man. So he's called Cabri Lake Man. So we have those kind of human effigies. We have turtle effigies. We have beaver effigies.
Are they laid out in stone?
Yes, they're laid out in stone. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So I couldn't tell you how many of those sites exist. Kim might be able to tell you that, but there's hundreds of them here in Saskatchewan.
Wow. Yeah. So people from outside this province best get here.
Yes.
It's not all about the Sphinx.
No, it's not all about the Sphinx. And well, our stuff maybe doesn't, the stuff doesn't stick up out of the ground. It's there. It's on the ground. You just have to look for it.
I got chills when you said discovering a flake and realizing somebody was here.
Yeah.
And there's got to be something in all of us that is drawn to the fact that there were people here before us, and there'll be people in the future that will be talking about us saying somebody was here, and it will be us.
It'll be us.
So archaeology is timeless.
It is, and everybody has archaeology. Like, it's the same as the human condition. Like, it's everybody has a past, whether you know what it is or you don't know what it is. It's there, and we are all tied together. We're all the same. We're all the same people. We're all the same species. We all come from somewhere. So while a lot of people in North America maybe didn't originate in North America, like my family history comes from the UK, but I feel much more connected to North American archaeology than I do, say, to Scottish archaeology. Mm-hmm. Love Scotland, beautiful place, but I've never lived there. My mom never lived there. Like, our connections here. So I can only imagine that times 10,000 years for the First Nations people that live here today, having that direct connection.
Right.
Yeah, but we are. There's archaeology connects everybody.
It's a good way to end this conversation.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Will you take me inside and introduce me to some people? Great, thanks.
I just want to say thank you very much. We're really happy to be able to come out and do the podcast.
Oh, so, I'm thrilled.
Yeah.
See, that's what happens when you follow SaskApes on Twitter.
Yes.
You'll hear from me. Thank you. So now I'm with Karen Stuber, who's the communications, are you communications director? Is that your official title?
My official title is public outreach coordinator.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay. But you also handle communications.
Yeah.
Right. So one of the components, Thomason and I touched on it briefly, but just because I know you're sort of part archaeological brain and part techno brain, talk to me a bit about the technology that we have now and how that's sort of advanced your field of archaeology.
Oh, the advent of newer technologies is constantly being adapted into the field of archaeology. I mean, you've got everything from DNA analysis of faunal remains, geochemistry, you know, borrowing a little bit from multiple different disciplines, and then just using social media and the internet to get all that information out there has been so helpful and has made archaeology very palatable and easy to access for anyone, basically, you know. And it's no longer confined to, you know, publications that are buried in a back room or a museum basement anymore. It's all out there on the internet, pretty much ready for anyone to grab it.
And do you conference around the world with other archaeologists? I mean, is that kind of global discussion that goes on?
It's starting to. I'm finding a lot with Twitter that a lot of archaeologists are starting to use it, and you kind of have like online Twitter conferences and stuff like that that later gets saved so you can review it through something like Storify. But it's definitely made it easier to talk to other professionals and just interested people as well.
Yeah, yeah. When did you become interested in archaeology? As a kid?
Oh, yeah. I went back to, I think, when I was 8 or 9 years old.
Really?
And it was just this fascination with history and wanting to learn more. And I did the typical route, you know, I wanted to excavate in the big temples, you know, Egyptology or Mesoamerica or things like that. You know, the archaeology that is most commonly heard about. But during my undergraduate degree, I did a field school at a site near Bodo, Alberta. So right near the Saskatchewan border. And fell in love with North American plains archaeology. Just thought it was so amazing that people have been here for over 10,000 years, you know, older than the pyramids in Egypt.
Yeah.
And have survived on this landscape with basically only natural objects that they can make tools out of. And I had to explore more about it.
Do you find that there are people in the field of archaeology that are driven to come and excavate here, that are drawn to that fascination that we have a history that's that old?
I think it's starting to more and more as we get the word out and really push that there's this deep, deep heritage here on the prairies. Maybe not so much 10 or 15 years ago, but definitely now more so with word of mouth getting out there. So, I mean, it drew me. One field school was enough to change my mind completely.
Right. So, I said to Thomason, imagine how many minds you've changed with the Archaeo Caravan Project.
We hope. We hope it's made a difference.
To. With 9,000, projected 9,000 kids you're going to get, you have
hopefully.
To.
Hopefully. Well, even if we can just get them away from thinking that archaeology is about dinosaurs, you know, nope, that's paleontology.
Right, right.
So that we've considered a success. So.
Right, right. So now in your position as public outreach with SAS, What's your own personal vision, like for three to 5 year long range forecast of where you'd like to see the organization head in public outreach?
Well, I think we're heading in the right direction already. Definitely more and more public events, just getting the word out there, getting people to know about us, sharing information. That's a major goal for us is, you know, we want to know what kind of archaeology is out there. Mm-hmm. You know, not only because we're curious as professional archaeologists, but, you know, just to get people involved and to have appreciation of what has happened in the past. So I think with us, it's onwards and upwards, you know, more visibility, the more we can do, school groups going to communities, and that's one of the things I think we do really, really well is especially with our Archaeo Caravan program, is going to all these different
Are
communities.
You traveling with that program a lot?
Not typically. Okay. I did the first year.
Did you?
That was my summer job. That's when I first started working for the SAS before I became, or the position of public outreach coordinator.
So a lot of driving.
A lot of driving, but it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Absolutely beautiful. Sunrises, sunsets, just different areas of the province, you know, distilling that notion of, oh, it's all flat. You know, just
and
to
it's
see
not.
The Yeah, just to see the beauty that's out there.
Yeah. I was talking to Laura just a few minutes ago. Do you think it's the hands-on experience that really is what draws people to the work you're doing?
You need that experiential learning, you know, get people hands in the dirt, you know, whether they're doing Archaeo Caravan activities and actually trying out rock painting or pottery making or having them come out to one of our field schools or public digs, you know.
Right.
So they can literally touch the past.
Right, right. Okay, very serious question. What are you doing in your position to dispel the myth that Indiana Jones is a true representation of your field?
I am probably really bad because I do have a fedora and I like to wear it on digs.
Right.
But no golden idols.
Right.
I haven't been chased by Nazis lately or been shot at by anyone. So, but you know what? It gets people interested.
It does. It's undeniable, right?
Exactly. You say, do you know who Indiana Jones was?
Right.
Yeah, most people do. It's like, okay, so let's talk about what he could have done better.
I think you should create an Indiana Jones type character for the Prairie Provinces, so that there's that same sort of exotic mystique around here, because I would think that it's tough to dispel that myth that it's all about the exotic worlds, the Egypts, the pyramids, the Sphinx. It's all about that.
But once you get people to start thinking about what it was like here in the past, okay, exotic isn't the right word, but hardy and interesting, you know, people start to realize, like, wow, no, a lot did go on here. So
yeah, come and spend a winter here and then you'll know what hardy is.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you'll wonder how people 10,000 years ago managed it when you can barely manage it now.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Well, great. It's great to see you're so active online with Facebook.
We try.
And Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And the website for the organization is?
www.saskarksoc.ca.
Right. And your Twitter handle?
@saskarksoc.
And clearly Facebook?
Is just look up the Saskatchewan Archaeological Society.
Right, there's lots of great articles there.
There's a fun
one about food.
Yeah, that was something I came up with in the last couple of months, is start to do kind of theme days, so our throwback Thursdays on Saskatchewan Archaeological Sites and our Foodie Fridays, so archaeology of food.
Yeah, no, that's great. It's a fascinating subject. That alone be a whole podcast episode on its own, the archaeology of food.
Oh, exactly.
Wow,
exactly.
Great. So, is there a little bit of crazy in archaeologists?
I think you have to be.
Yeah, yeah.
Who else goes out and licks bones and rocks? You know?
Yeah, yeah. I think that's why I was saying to Lori, a lot of y'all end up marrying each other.
Well, who better understands you than another archaeologist?
I guess so, right? Right. Well, thanks. Here's to a successful reception tonight. And tomorrow's lineup is amazing.
I'm looking forward to
it.
So.
Thanks, Karen.
Thank you, Kevin.
Tam Nguyen, thank you for taking some time to talk to me. I'd like to know a bit about your story. Where are you originally from?
I'm actually born and raised in Saskatoon, but my parents immigrated from Vietnam after the Vietnam War. My dad was a lieutenant in the South Vietnamese Air Force, and he was part of the first wave of Vietnamese boat people.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's a whole different podcast in its own right there.
But, I bet.
But, yeah, the short version of the story is that they left Vietnam, took a couple tries, and when they got here, I was born. So I was the first one born here.
In Saskatoon?
In Saskatoon.
And there's quite a large community now. Was there how was the community of Vietnamese in Saskatoon when you were born?
Very closely knit. A lot of the folks were part of the first wave of the exodus, and some of them, in fact, left Vietnam before the fall of Saigon in 75.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually how we ended up here, or my family ended up here, because my auntie she got out before the fall of Saigon. And while my parents were in the refugee camp in the Philippines, she got a sponsor to come to Saskatoon. So that's how we ended up here. And yeah, most of the Vietnamese folk that you all see kicking around Saskatoon now, of the older generation, are from that wave.
Right.
And yeah, they all know each other, and it's a fairly tight community.
Right, right. So tell me about archaeology in your lifetime. What can you remember? You've studied archaeology, yes? You are an archaeologist?
Yes.
Professionally?
Yes. I am a professional archaeologist. I work for a consulting company called Golder Associates. Archaeology, this is probably incredibly embarrassing for me to admit, but I was one of those people that did not know what archaeology was.
Okay.
When I started university, I wanted to be a veterinarian, and I was picking all my classes out, and I had two electives left, and I decided to pick this archaeology and anthropology, thinking that archaeology was the study of dinosaurs. And quickly learned that was not the case, but quickly fell in love with the topic matter, just the idea of exploring the past through the material remains, and how archaeologists have the tools and the capacity to extrapolate the stories associated with these physical remains. And I quickly fell in love with that idea. And I went and had a meeting with Dr. Ernie Walker at that point, and asked him about career choices and what I need to do to make this a viable career. And fast forward 15 years later, here I am now. I graduated with my BA honors in 2006, and I got my master's in 2010. And yeah, I've been doing archaeology ever since.
So how often do you get out in the field?
Quite regularly.
Yes.
Yeah, it's since most of my work is tied to industry, it's a little slower in the winter, but there are still things that happen, but most of the work is done when the ground thaw is gone and the sun is shining and you can essentially dig, put a shovel in the ground.
Right, yeah. Yes. So what is it about Saskatchewan, in your opinion, that's incredibly unique in this field of archaeology? So this has a Saskapes has a global audience. So for somebody that's listening to this that's outside of Canada, what is it that we have to offer that's really, really unique?
That's a tricky question. I've always been fascinated with Saskatchewan archaeology in the sense that when you think of archaeology elsewhere in the world, there are lots of architectural landmarks. You go to the old world, there's a lot of beautiful medieval architecture and stuff like that. And here on the plains, certainly in the more recent history, we have, during the settling of the West, we have your homesteads, your farmsteads, and kind of those structures, and then some more recent historic architectural anomalies that people appreciate. But in terms of prehistory, we don't really have a whole lot to go off in terms of architecture. Really what we're limited to would be stone circles, stone features,
right,
stone cairns, medicine wheels, effigies. And to most people, taking my friends for example, they look at like, well, a stone circle, whoop-de-doo, what can you tell about that? Or, okay, that looks like a turtle, so what? But it's the idea of what I find fascinating is why it was there in the first place. A stone circle on its own can't really tell you a whole lot, but when you look at the collective distribution of sites across the province, you can tell the movement of people, where they hunted, where they traveled, where they settled. Things like medicine wheels, vision quests, and effigies, usually they would be located on a landform that provides a commanding view. When you go hiking and you climb to the top of a nice peak and you got this panoramic view, and for that split second, that view kind of takes your breath away. And that's, to me, the fun of doing archaeology in the province, is that initial discovery. I still get that rush when I find a new site. It's like, this is something that hasn't been recorded and hasn't been documented. No one really knows about this. This is the first time that it's being recognized.
And what you're unearthing is incredibly old, some of the things that you're finding, dating back 9,000 years ago. So I don't know that everybody would automatically associate Saskatchewan with being able to find that kind of history going back that far.
Well, and that's just the other thing, right? Like, again, we don't have a whole lot of medieval architecture just because of the nature of the settlement, but we have history. And our history in that age is hidden. And when you uncover it, you're the first one to uncover it for how many thousands of years. And it's that contribution to the ever-growing collective knowledge of archaeology in the province. And that's why guys like me do what we do. We're trying to add to that knowledge, because there's a lot that we know, but there's also a lot that we don't.
What's it like when you're out in the field? I mean, there'll be different numbers of you in the group when you're on a particular site, right? I mean, you're not on your own, or are you?
It depends on the scope of the project. Sometimes you're on your own, sometimes you're in a big group. So it really depends kind of the scale of what you're doing. So, yeah, that's kind of a tricky one to answer.
Right. When you're out there on your own, What does that feel like? I mean, it's incredibly isolating. You're there with your own thoughts, but it must feel kind of special in a way, especially if you're on your own and you unearth something.
I find it incredibly refreshing, actually. As I mentioned, you know, when if you're in the grasslands, let's say Grasslands National Park, and you hike on top of a nice knoll and you find something, it's that initial rush that, you know, it's like it's kind of, and I don't want to say an outer body experience, but it's kind of like, you know, this view is something that someone in the past stood and thought the same thing as me. Mm-hmm. It's like, wow, you know, you can see for miles and miles and miles, and there's something magical about your, you know, this specific piece of land. And certainly, usually, not always, if you look hard enough, there will usually be something there.
And when you're with a group on a site, do you all talk? I mean, is it a relatively quiet environment? I have no idea what it's like out there.
Usually in the bigger groups, you would be excavating a known site. So that's where, you know, that media image of a bunch of archaeologists kneeled over a square hole, slowly brushing away.
Right.
That's when that happens.
Okay.
And yeah, for them, usually, you know, everyone's talking about what they're finding, and, you know, one person finds a projectile point, the other one gets excited, and then everyone shares in that collective excitement, and then it kind of builds some motivation for the group. And, you know, you kind of need that when you're out excavating a site for 20 days on end. And,
right. Yeah, you must have to be incredibly patient as an archaeologist.
Yes. Yes, incredibly patient. Yeah. That's you nailed it right there.
No A-type personalities in archaeology.
Not that I know of. I'm sure there are some out there hidden, but they hide it pretty well.
Right. So talk to me about SAS. You've been president of the board for how long?
I'm just finishing my first term right now. I've been a member of the SAS since 2007 when I started my master's degree. I've been on the board probably for that long as well. And the reason I got involved with the SAS is just that I wanted to make a difference in how the public perceives archaeology in Saskatchewan.
Because it's more about the story than the thing? Is that where you want to see the emphasis swing?
Yes. I'm sure if you ask other archaeologists, they might have a different perspective, but that's always been kind of my perspective.
Mm-hmm.
It's the story behind the things, not necessarily the things itself.
Mm-hmm. And so you're encouraged with the direction the SAS is headed in as far as marrying that storytelling aspect of, you know, and balancing it out with the thing. I mean, the two seem to be intertwined to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't fully tear them both apart, but you're just, that must really embrace the First Nations community in a whole new realm now for you guys, because they are such a story-driven culture.
Mm-hmm.
They must play a really important role in the direction you're headed.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's just it. I think there is a renewed respect that archaeology as a discipline and as a profession is slowly moving towards this intermarriage between the story behind the thing, mm-hmm. as opposed to the thing itself.
And mm-hmm. Right. Thanks for filling me in a bit on your background.
Well, thanks for having me.
So now I'm with Laura Foley. You're a retired... Oh, you're a U of S professor now.
Mm-hmm. Well, but I taught as a sessional for most of my other teaching career. I always said I had two lives, that my work as a elementary school teacher and principal, and then my work as an archaeologist. And for 17 years, I worked with the university and the SAS to coordinate an archaeological project in Saskatoon's inner city, the core neighborhoods near St. Mary's Community School.
Okay.
And we had four core neighborhood schools, one middle class school, who the senior students would have a chance to dig with university students. I would coordinate running back and forth between my other work. What really intrigued me was they were working with a small area that had previously been a garbage dump. And while they found much clinker and historic artifacts. We also were lucky enough in the 17 years to find one pre-contact artifact that was at least 1,500 years old.
Wow.
And just reminded everyone who was here first.
Now, what was it that you found?
It was a broken stone tool, and the point could be dated. So various academics at the university held the formal license, and then I was able to recruit funding. So grad students, many of the students, and even staff from the SAS, like Karen, who was at that point a student, worked on site. The other piece was that we had at least a half day for every student on campus with the teachers so that they could also see how archaeology could be integrated in the curriculum. Mm. And as you know, perhaps, the SAS, both through committees but also through the staff finding funds, we have online a curriculum linked to the Saskatchewan education curriculum from grade 4 through 9, showing teachers where archaeology could, of the plains especially, could easily be integrated into the curriculum.
Now, your background of study is in archaeology, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, just wanted to clarify that.
No. So, I started in history and archaeology and then went in and did an MA and then a B.Ed., and I did a second MA later in my career in archaeology. But my excavation experience has been in Israel and Jordan.
Wow.
And so that's my training and why I call myself an old world archaeologist.
Okay.
But
and that was by choice that you went there?
Well, that was also by training. So I did ancient history and classics and languages, and then my first field experience was in Israel working in an Iron Age site from about 1000 BC.
Wow. So these are pretty exotic locations you're talking about in my mind. So bring it back to Saskatchewan. Mm-hmm. What is it? What is it that excites you about what we're finding here?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, it's about the presence and power of landscape. And, you know, even if you aren't excavating, as you walk the trails here at Wanuskewin or are involved, we are working with a colleague and friend, Mark Kennedy, also a member of SAS, on a landscape survey project in southern Saskatchewan near Etonia, Saskatchewan, that you can be on the land, and as you come upon a cairn or you look at a stone circle, whether it's a partial circle or a complete circle, you feel the presence of mm-hmm. past people.
Absolutely.
And then when you get your hands dirty with a licensed excavation, because of course you shouldn't be digging about, right. you have another perspective.
Right. So how often do you get to get out on a site now?
For the last number of years, our work has been doing survey work. My husband is an archaeologist too, and he does all kinds of assessment with GIS type of material. So I would be on the land most summers for 2 to 3 weeks. And when I was younger and we had university students overseas, our excavation time was 6 to 8 weeks.
So, wow. What's it like out there on
well,
site?
On site, anywhere is at times hard physical work. We used to tell students it was like construction work, and a couple of them said, nah, this is more like medium construction work.
Uh-huh.
But it's also important that you're documenting all the time, because it's deconstruction work.
Right.
Once we have excavated, you can't put it back. And whether it's a broken piece of pottery or a broken tool or something fantastic, it's about recognizing, as you hold that small point here on the plains or a bigger piece of pottery in another style of excavation overseas, that you're touching the past. And you have to think about who made this, who used it, why was this particular item placed in this context. And it's the excitement of ongoing learning, as well as the excitement of teamwork, because archaeology doesn't work unless we're all in it together, documenting, recording, and the physical work of the excavation, as well as sifting and the kind of processing that we all do later.
You've brought up something that I've really wanted to talk about, and forgive me, this is not my field at all, so I'm coming at it really as a newbie. So this question is born out of pure innocence. I'll say that rather than ignorance. You said that you can't, once you unearth something, you can't put it back. You've really traveled the world in your field. Is there ever a time when it's so profound that what you found, profound isn't the right word, but is there a spiritual component to something that you would find which would just suggest we must leave this?
it's an interesting question.
Okay.
And I would have permission from Elder Mary Lee, who is a well-respected elder originally from Big River First Nation, who lives just outside of Saskatoon.
Mm-hmm.
And so her teaching to me is, if, especially here on the Great Plains and in Saskatchewan, if you feel that there's a sacred space, then you should try to connect with those people or with a respected elder who is there. And I was involved with a project near Eagle Creek many years ago with the school board, and Mary, along with other First Nations people, and had invited me, and we were touring the area, and she said, you know, I feel there were burials here. This shouldn't be excavated.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you that has always been respected. It is an area that's been documented with stone circles. And I actually am working with a program at the university now called the Aboriginal Student Achievement Program with first-year archaeology students. And we connect with Mary and the Catholic School Board to use Eagle Creek along with Oskayak students. And if she's not there, she has allowed me to share that that's her teaching. And out of the 13 teepee rings that were documented, because of the way the grass has grown, only two are easily visible now. And to watch all students, but especially those who know that they were among Canada's first peoples, whether they're Cree or Dene or Soto or Sioux, to look and say, yes, I understand why people were here. It's not in the very top crest, but close to Eagle Creek. Why wouldn't you be in the top crest? Well, we can all think about what winter was like.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the rings is a double ring, so they can see the dynamism that on this stone circle, it was probably a winter encampment, and to think about the richness of the plains. There's just visible excitement, and that doesn't involve excavation. So for the university students, but I've also shared this material with the high school teachers, they can expand upon that around documenting by measuring, by using GPSs, by looking at articles on licensed excavations, which talk about the organization of the teepee archaeologically, and that's been supported by the teaching of elders and by Indigenous knowledge and that spirit of shared dynamism. So with my experience overseas, there are traditions, especially around burials, and always the local traditions would be respected. And that is true in Canada. Burials aren't excavated without some very specialized conditions being met. And in here on the plains, mm-hmm. always the involvement of the local First Nations community.
Right, right. You've taught a younger demographic during your career.
Mm-hmm.
Have you found it a challenge to excite kids about getting involved in their past? Has that been, we're in such a technology-driven society
right.
now. How's that been for you?
I think hands-on learning, whether it's for us as adults, for the university students, or for elementary students, it's always for us the best way to learn. So the grade 7 and 8, and occasionally a few younger students who were involved with the archaeological project, the Grace Adam Metawabinick Archaeological Project, they would do some work learning with the normal type of presentations, but it's the hands-on material. And I've done the same kinds of things if I've been invited by a teacher to come in and talk about old world archaeology. If you can bring in elements that they can touch, a Roman coin, a piece of pottery, but a stone tool here on the plains, kids are excited. They want to know more. Mm-hmm. And it was easy to get them excited knowing that they would be spending time actually excavating. And I found in my 5 years at St. Mary's Community School that some students who might have been viewed as the more challenging students were the ones who begged to stay after class, that they wanted to help clean up. Huh, they wanted to be involved, and that was for them the hands-on work, but work where they knew their ancestors had been.
You must have been thrilled with the Archaeo Caravan Project.
Well, I was president of the Archaeological Society.
Was this your baby?
Yeah. and part of the Archaeo Caravan is another element we did with GAMAP, or the Grace Adam Project, is we brought the 5 schools together, the students who were involved, so that would be between 150 and 200 kids.
Yeah.
We would work with staff and elders to erect a teepee early in the morning. We had elders speak and with appropriate ceremony and donation of tobacco. And at the conclusion, so the children met each other and also participated in a round dance. And that's always challenging, right? 200 kids were sitting in 5 different schools not knowing each other.
Yeah.
But the concluding activity was like a mini Archaeo Caravan. And so we had usually about 10 stations, and many of the stations that are part of the Archaeo Caravan, not all of them, the fur trader game we never played. That's an invention that has been modified. But working with pottery and the idea of pictographs and painting and trying to make stone tools, teaching with elders. Usually we had a hands-on, a small First Nations jewelry issue, and staff and volunteers who publicly made bannock, and that was an eating station, pretty popular.
Mm-hmm.
So that, we called it the day in the park, and with the involvement of the SAS and other volunteers, we knew that expanding the project. And this is about staff who worked on the proposals to get funding, and their initiative of the link with museums. That was something that the board, of which I was a member at that time, said, yep, we know that will really work. And so archaeology has touched students throughout the province, not just throughout the 5 selected schools, really, with the Archaeo Caravan, just a terrific project, and we want to give full credit to staff and their involvement.
You said your husband's an archaeologist as well.
Yeah, we met at university.
Is that common? Do archaeologists often hook up?
I think so. If you take a look, there are a number of couples.
Yeah.
But we were both interested in the old world, and both of us started with languages, which then as you have an opportunity to excavate, your hands get dirty, and it stays with you in lots of good ways.
Right. Thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you for asking and
my pleasure.
Putting together this material for the SAS.
Yeah, my pleasure. Evelyn Siegfried, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
You're very popular here at the 53rd Annual Gathering.
Didn't realize that.
You are.
But that's fun.
I want to hear about your story. Tell me where you're from originally.
Well, originally from Alberta. I was born in Elk Point, in a noble little town in northeast Alberta. And I never lived there.
Okay.
I was just born there. And then my father was working in Fishing Lake at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And later he got a job with Indian Affairs. And we moved around a lot within Alberta. So I lived all over Alberta. I lived in Calgary, Brockett, High Prairie, Fort Vermilion, Fort McMurray.
When did you come here?
After I graduated from my PhD program at the University of Calgary.
And you did that in what field?
In archaeology.
Aha.
I did all my degrees in archaeology at the University of Calgary, a BA, an MA, and then a PhD.
So you are a professional archaeologist?
Yes, by trade.
By trade, right. Yes. Tell me, I'm always fascinated by this. What was it? What's your earliest memory that you can think of that might have created that initial spark of interest in archaeology for you?
I have a little story.
Yes?
When I was about 12 years old, we were living in High Prairie, and I had a friend who lived at the edge of town along the little creek that ran through the town, so it was on the edge. And we used to go and make rafts there and play in the creek, and his sister had a horse, which had a little corral along the edge of that creek. And I went to play with them one day, and they were busy and couldn't come out at the time. So I just went to the top edge of the creek and was sitting looking down at it, slowly meandering. And the leaves were rustling in the wind, and the sun was shining. So it was dappled sunlight trickling down. And I ran my fingers through the very black soil on the edge of the creek bank. And as I was digging, it was gorgeous black, rich soil, and I was playing with it, and all of a sudden in my hand there was something gold glinting. It was a gold coin.
Wow.
And it turned out that it belonged to the grandparents of my friend, who the grandparents had homesteaded in High Prairie. And they had built a little log cabin, and that cabin was now the horse's shed. And so they had swept out the house and swept all the garbage and thrown it over the bank of that creek, right where I had been sitting. And who knows how that gold coin ended up?
No kidding.
In that dirt, but there it was. And so I, of course, my shock was amazing. I was like, wow. Wow, I've found something incredible. I couldn't believe it. So I ran to their house and knocked on the door, rap, 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 rap. Mrs. Fabing, look what I found down by the creek. Sorry, I And she looked down at this coin and burst into tears in front of me. And I was standing there 12 years, of course, mystified, looking at her. Well, you'd think this would be something incredible and happy.
Yeah.
Well, it turned out, it made her cry because it was the last coin from their family that I had serendipitously found.
Wow.
So they had a whole sack of them, apparently, at one point, which they had kept in their freezer in a sock.
Oh.
And they went on holidays. one year, and while they were away, their house got broken into and robbed, and people found the sack of coins in the freezer and stole them all.
Oh,
so
no.
They lost the inheritance. So this gold coin being found by me on the side of the, it was just, incredible. And so it was the realization that something came up from the ground. I didn't really know about archaeology then, but later, when I was 20, and I was looking at, I went to Europe, and I was in Sweden, I was in Stockholm, and I borrowed a book from the library, and it was a story of archaeology, and the light bulb went on. I remembered this moment of finding that coin, and thought, well, you can make a living digging in the ground, looking for stuff, right? And so I thought, that's what I want to do. So I came back to Canada for my European holiday, and I started going to university with the goal of eventually one day being an archaeologist. But I also had some, as I went through that, I transitioned a little bit, because it wasn't about treasures in the end, like finding gold coins and that kind of thing. My mother is First Nations, so we came under treaty with Bill C-31 in 1985, and so I always knew that heritage, right? We visited my grandfather when we were children through, we didn't live on the reserve, but we'd visit, we'd go back to the reserve and visit family and so on. And I knew that he had a lot of special knowledge. He was a man of the bush. He didn't speak very much English, but he could live in the bush. He had all this knowledge of how to make things, what to eat, and everything. And I had planned to learn from him, but he passed away when I was in grade, at the end of my grade 11. And so my plans of maybe one day living with him and learning from him were gone. And I thought, well, how else can I learn about the past? I can learn about the past through archaeology. And so I pursued that. I went to university and just took my 40 courses as an undergrad and, you know, got my degree. And then was looking around, was thinking about the possibilities of graduate school. I wasn't sure about it, but I bumped into a friend at university, and she was doing ethnobotany of the Blackfoot people. Her name was Sandra Peacock. And we had been undergrads together, but she'd moved on into the master's program in archaeology. And she talked about it, and I realized, wait a minute, I've heard things from my mother about the use of plants in the past in the bush. I wonder if anybody's ever researched that up in northern Alberta.
Yeah.
And so I went and did some research and found out that nobody had ever gone up into the northern part of Alberta to talk to any Cree people about how plants were used in the past. So that was another a new path for me to move into in terms of learning about the past. So it wasn't, it had an archaeological perspective in that, you know, people use plants. They pick sometimes the whole plant or sometimes just parts of the plant.
Mm-hmm.
And they might dispose of a plant, parts of a plant that they don't need, or they cache the parts that they do need. And that will leave an archaeological remain.
Right.
So, you know, the perspective of the ethnobotany that I did was to look at how people use plants, what they did with them, what their activities were with them, and think about what impact that would have on the archaeological record. And would we be able to recover materials mm-hmm. from the ground in the boreal forest? And so on, and what we could we learn from that?
And can they find
well,
plant
is
material?
It is difficult mm-hmm. Because the forest is so acidic, so a lot of material doesn't survive.
Right.
So if it's a younger site, there's a possibility. But if it's older,
mm-hmm.
The likelihood of finding something special drops. In the case of my PhD, what I worked on was paleoethnobotany, which was looking at farther back in time, it was archaeological. And we just happened to have a site in northwest Calgary, the Tuscany site, EGPN 377, and it had a paleosol, an old soil, and actually it turned out to be a series of old soils that had charred botanical remains in them. So we sampled at a rate of 1%.
Yeah.
but we took sediment samples and washed away the dirt and got left with the charred botanical remains.
How did that survive?
The charring process.
Is the remarkable
part of that, because if they hadn't been charred, they would never have survived.
Huh.
But being charred, they changes them and made them hard enough to survive time.
Wow.
and the effects of, you know, a rising and drop falling water table.
Yeah.
And so on. So it was exciting because I found, you know, I was looking through these I wasn't absolutely sure of what I was doing at first, but I was looking through samples under the microscope, and they're small. They're in the range of, you know, 2 millimeters, 3 millimeters, and some, and the seeds, you know, down to 1 millimeter and less, ooh, right? So very tiny under the microscope.
You, no wonder you all wear glasses.
Yes. It was kind of painstaking. But I remember the eureka moment when I was looking at something and I thought, what, that looks like a, it looks like a seed coat, the inside of a seed coat of an almond.
Oh.
But, you know, only 2 millimeters, yeah, right? And so I thought, what does that remind me of? It reminds me of a seed. And then I realized it is a seed. You know, I had that eureka moment, and then I started to see seeds everywhere, right? But I had to get to that point where the light bulb went on, and I started finding, and I had to go back through a bunch of samples that I'd already done because I'd missed the seeds.
I just can't believe even finding the charred ones. Yeah, I mean, we're talking something so tiny.
They were extremely tiny. Yeah. It was really. I felt it was serendipity. You know, that I began to recognize what was there. So I found, you know, I identified juniper, kinnikinick, Indian paintbrush, Schafardia canadensis. What else? Just various kinds of plants that grow in a prairie transition parkland ecotone. So it wasn't entirely prairie kind of. There was also spruce cone scales. I think I had a couple of spruce seeds. So you know, there's evidence of at least a little bit of forest. How, you know, whether or not there were actually spruce trees growing in that site. It was a swale, so a little hollow on the on a bench overlooking the Bow River.
Mm.
There certainly was some trees growing down in the coulee, but when you looked at pictures from the 1920s and the turn of the century, there were no trees. The prairie was denuded. Right. All the stuff that we were seeing in 1995, 96, 97 was growth that had happened because of the demise of the bison and, you know, through time and changes in how that landscape was managed. It wasn't burned off. The bison didn't nibble everything off anymore, and so on. It had changed through time, and that was because of the coming of Europeans into the landscape and their change in the use of that landscape.
Right.
So,
your First Nations background leads me to this next question, which is the whole discussion around archaeology and the First Nations community. Mm-hmm. What I understand, my observation in doing this podcast series over the last few years, it's an incredibly beautiful culture, and it's a story-driven culture.
Mm.
And I don't get the sense, though this is a very uneducated guess, that there's a sense of urgency to unearth things, to disturb the past that way. So how does archaeology intertwine with First Nations history?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, I remember being on the movie set. There was they had archaeologists on the set. They asked us to come from the university to be part of the set and pretend we were doing archaeology in this uh-huh. movie. And there was some Blackfoot. There was a couple of young fellows from Morley that were on the set. And so of course we got into a discussion and we were talking about archaeology. And he said, this young fellow said, you know, it's a waste of time, and we're not interested in it at all because we don't need it. We have elders who can see. They can see the past, mm-hmm. and they can see the future. They don't need to dig in the ground to find anything. They know what's there. You know, it was really, so for me, I had never, you know, even being First Nations, I'd never really heard that perspective. And of course, you hear elders here saying the same thing mm-hmm. here in Saskatchewan, saying that there are elders who can see. They could, you know, they have that gift.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's, it's interesting that maybe they really don't feel the need to excavate in the ground the way we so painstakingly do, because they know that past. Yeah. And it's not, and it's certainly not my place to question
mm-hmm.
that,
mm-hmm.
you know, them saying that, right? The, who am I to say, nah,
yeah.
you know, I don't disbelieve it,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
I accept it.
Yeah.
And, but I myself, I don't have that vision.
Okay, you know, right.
I wasn't raised that traditional way, and mm-hmm. so it hasn't, it's not a gift that's been given to me.
Mm-hmm.
So my way to find it is through archaeology and through excavation.
Well, the gift that was given to you was that gold coin.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it changed my life, right? You know, really, when you think about it.
So you've been coming to these gatherings for how long?
Since about 2005, 2006.
Okay. So it's old home week, huh?
So,
when you all
yeah.
get together.
It's nice. It's a friendly affair. And I'm not presenting this year, but in the past I have come and done little talks. And
mm-hmm.
It's like being with a big family.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to be scared to get up there and present and you right. know.
What a pleasure it is to meet. I could mm-hmm. sit here and just listen to you talk all afternoon. I'm not just saying that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Well, it's been my pleasure to be here.
Hey, thanks for listening. Music for Saskapes is provided by Saskatchewan-born singer-songwriter Jeffrey Straker. It's so exciting to see Saskapes being downloaded by a global audience. Remember, if you're in Saskatchewan and have a story that needs to be heard, contact me about how you can become a sponsor. Stories from our past and our present, they're all waiting to be told from here in the land of the living skies. So until next time...